Hi, everyone. My name is Adam, and I'm an alcoholic. And by God's grace and the help of AA, I've been sober since June 28th, 1996. And for that, I'm very grateful. And God, can you all hear my heart pounding up here? I mean, this is, I did not know I was going to be doing this tonight. Stephanie is not joking. I came by to actually just confirm that I was speaking on the 18th for her. And she said, no, you're speaking tonight, actually. You know, and, oh, shit. You know, I mean, what do you do? Well, you know, the cool thing about it is that, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has really made it possible for me to not only say yes, but to say yes to Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that sounds very strange, but what I mean by that, of course, is that it never would have occurred to me to say no. The kind of person that I was when I came in here, you know, I wouldn't have done anything unless I'd known there was something in it for me. And, you know, I just am thrilled to be asked, and it didn't even occur to me to say no. And so, Steph, thank you so much for asking me, and I'm really glad I could help you out. And hope this talk is everything you wanted it to be. You know, I don't know. I also just want to really welcome those of you who are new, and I want to let you know I'm living a really good life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sure you could care less, but, you know, but I care. You know, when I woke up this morning, first of all, I woke up, I didn't come to, and when I did so, I knew where I was. I was in my own apartment, in my own bed. I knew how I got there. I knew who I was with, and it was nobody, and that was a blessing. And, you know, it's a really action-packed life in a lot of ways. You know, I have a job that I absolutely love. I work in international education, and what I do basically is I send college students over to foreign countries to go bottom out in their alcoholism, and I keep a chair warm for them while they're here. Because that's precisely how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 21 years old when I showed up, and the preceding year before that had basically been 9 solid months of drinking in Japan. Has anybody ever been to Japan, by the way? None of you? I see a few heads going up and down, so you know about the beer vending machines then, right? Oh, thank God for the beer vending machines. You know, I always know I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mentioned the beer vending machines, and a few newcomers go like this. Okay, you have my attention. You know. Oh, God, they were wonderful. You know, going to any hotel, go up to the third floor, plunk in 500 yen, and there's no greedy bartender tip, and nobody saying, don't you think you've had enough? Oh, fantastic, you know. A few of them outside of 7-Elevens. They're great. They're great, you know. So convenient. But, you know, when you, I mean, I lived out in the sticks in Japan, actually, you know, and when you were the only white guy around for about 12 miles, you know, they do notice. They do notice you. I mean, I'd be standing out by the 7-Eleven drinking a tall boy that I had purchased out of it, and in my mind, I'm in some dimly lit bar watching my very beautiful friends play pool, and, of course, I'm way too cool to play pool and too good, so sitting there drinking, you know, and out of the 7-Eleven comes some, you know, little Japanese high school girl in the uniform and everything like that. She takes one look at me, and I go like this. And she runs for her life. And as she's going, I'm thinking, my God, she totally thinks I'm hot, man. You know, and I clacked that beer can against the vending machine like I was giving it a cheers with a beer stein or something like that. Because, you know, and I like to tell that story because I remember once I lived in Chicago for a little while. And I used to go to this young people's meeting out in Bucktown. And I remember this little 16-year-old girl saying to me, you are like the coolest person I ever met because you drank out of a beer vending machine. Yeah. And I told her that story, and all of a sudden, I wasn't as cool anymore, you know, and I don't know. And it's really cute and everything like that, but, you know, that was not exactly where I had intended for alcohol to take me, was, you know, standing by myself with nothing but a 7-Eleven, rice patties, a beer vending machine, and a drunken white guy. That is exactly where alcohol took me. It took me to a lot worse places. It took me to the basement of my residence hall, drinking beer that I had stolen out of the refrigerator. I was the kind of thief that broke into your apartment and raided your refrigerator and your medicine cabinet. That, you know, I wasn't interested in your money. I wanted whatever it was that you had that was going to get me away from being on myself, you know. And I would be drinking down there in the basement, not because I was having a good time and not because, you know, drinking was fun anymore, but because now I got to make the evidence of what I've stolen disappear. And that's not exactly where I'd intended for alcohol to take me either. But there was no not drinking. Never occurred to me to not drink. And it's really funny that that's kind of the place where alcohol took me, you know, because I had a mother who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I logged a lot of seat time in Al-Anon. Are there any Al-Anon, Alateen members here? Any double winners? No? No one's going to fess up, I guess. Okay. Well, it's all right. I'll fess up. I logged a lot of seat time in Al-Anon, and I never worked the 12 steps because I didn't know I had a spiritual malady, and I was 14, you know? I mean, what did I know about anything? Though I will say this much, I'm really grateful to Al-Anon and Alateen for at least planting the concept of the 12 steps in my mind so that it kind of made my drinking a little shorter. There are a lot of people in here, I'm sure, that have heard that old cliche about having to having a belly full of wine and a head full of AA, you know, and I had something like that, you know, and I think if not for that, I probably would have been out there a lot longer, dying a lot longer. But yeah, I had a mother who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had logged a lot of seat time in Al-Anon, and I was sure it wasn't going to happen to me. Well, it happened, and it happened big time. And, you know, I didn't want to come to AA, not at 21 years old, not when it was finally legal for me to drink in this country, and not with my mother. Oh, God, anybody but her. You know, no. But I was in a lot of pain the night before my first meeting. I actually really like to talk about my first meeting very much. We've all had a first meeting, you know, and I remember mine like it happened yesterday. Just real quickly, here's how it happened. The night before, I showed up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 7:30 with my mother. I was out at a pool hall with the only two people left in my life who were still crazy enough to hang out with me. And I, you know, to this day, I don't know what it was that set me off, but something sure did, because one minute I was fine, and the next thing I knew, I was whipping a pool cue at them, just left and right, screaming at the top of my lungs that I wanted to see the color of their blood. And, you know, I didn't get myself into that kind of shape just once. You know, that was real common for me. And if you're new, I want you to know this also. That was real common for me when I was not drinking. Okay, I'm the kind of person that they describe in this book when they say restless, irritable, and discontent. Until he has a drink. And I didn't do restless, irritable, and discontent in moderation either, obviously. But I didn't do it once either. That was real common. Something would set me off, and the next thing I know, I was driving you up the same wall that I was climbing, and I was not being nice about it. And it was a whole lot of not pretty. What ended up happening was the guy who I was out with a guy and a girl. They were boyfriend and girlfriend. He caught the pool cue on an in-swing, whipped it out of my hand, grabbed me by the front of the shirt, brought my nose right up to mine, and said, "Shut the hell up! Just shut up!" And I was so shocked that he had done that, that I did shut, you know, and his voice dropped a few notches, and he just said to me, "Adam, go home. Go home. Don't even offer us a ride. We're not going to get in the car with you. We'll figure out a way to get home. Just don't come near me anymore. Don't come near Rachel anymore. Just get the hell out of the lives. And whatever you do, don't say you're sorry, because you're not. You say you're sorry all the time, and then you do it again. You do this all the time, and I'm not taking it anymore. I'm not going to let her take it anymore either. Get the hell out of my life." And it was like a piano kind of hit the ground inside of me somewhere. And I was just devastated because I knew he was right. I hadn't gotten myself in that kind of shape just once. Well, guess what? I get behind the wheel of the car and magically it drives itself to a bar. Surprise, surprise. And I'm sitting there in that bar and I am hurting worse than I've ever hurt in my life. And God, I want to have a drink. But what's crowding that out is the night of my last drunk. Another place alcohol took me to, and I didn't mean to go there. I was in Japan. I've been drinking every day because that temper was out of control when I wasn't drinking, and it just seemed safer to stay drunk. I knew that the kind of violence I was capable of would have gotten me deported, and thank God for those beer vending machines, man. That's not funny. Yes, it is, actually. What am I kidding? I just remember that last night that I got drunk. You know, I was on the swim team, and you know, I was on the college swim team in Japan, and the nights had been ending pretty much the same way. I would get there promising I was just going to have two, and magically 2 would turn into 4, and 4 would turn into 8, and 8 would turn into 16, and they started bringing hefty garbage bags to these parties because I was the only person that would, like, throw up as much as I did, and, you know, they would bring these garbage bags for me to throw up into, and the night was over when I was carried out, one person holding me up here, and in my hand is a hefty garbage bag full of my own vomit, and I'm being carried off to wherever it is I'm going to come to. And that last night, I wouldn't let somebody carry me home because I was embarrassed and I was ashamed. And so without garbage bags present, I threw up on every train that I rode home. And there were 4 of them between Yagoto, where I was, and Sakae, where I was heading. And I got off the train at Sakabe and crawled on my hands and knees to my host family's house. My host mother took one look at me and said, "Oh, honey, you're not going to make it up the stairs." They put me in the back room, which is the room where the family's grandmother had been in the last days of her life. And it was the only room in the house with an adjacent toilet. And I use that word very liberally. That's not funny either. It was basically a cesspit with a toilet seat on top of it. And this is the kind of contraption you had to pour maggot killer down once a month. And I wasn't done throwing up. And this ain't the kind of contraption you want to rest your cheek on because it's nice and cool either. Y'all are pretty sick if you think that's funny. And it is. But it's a whole lot of not funny because I'm laying there, I'm singing the Alcoholic National Anthem. Y'all know the Alcoholic National Anthem. Let's sing it together. Oh God, if you get me out of this, I'll never drink again, right? Okay. Yeah. And just like everything else that was coming out of my mouth, it was a lie too, because of course I drink again after that, because I'm an alcoholic, and my choice has been made. You know, I can't remember the suffering and humiliation of that night the next time somebody puts a drink in front of me, and I didn't remember it the next time somebody put a drink in front of me. But I remembered what my friend said when he caught the pool cue on the inswing and ripped it out of my hand, and how bad it hurt, and how much I wanted to drink. But that was the first time I actually thought about the consequences, and I actually thought about what was going to happen if I got behind the wheel of the car, if I got that drunk, and I knew that somebody was going to die, and it wasn't going to be me, and that I was going to have to live sober through whatever came after killing somebody in a drunk driving accident. And I got scared. I got really scared, and I think this is kind of where God put his foot in the door and said, "All right, that's it. You're through. You're done." Because that car went into drive, and I drove home at 2 miles an hour, and I sat up and I waited for my mom to take me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she got up. There I was sitting on the couch, still fully dressed, shaking. I said, "Mom, I need you to take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous with you. I'm an alcoholic." And she just looked at me with all the seriousness in the world, and she said, "No, you're not." And I said, "Yeah, I am, Mom. I'm an alcoholic." And she said, "No, you're not. I just told you you're not. You're not. Go back to your ALA team meetings. You'll be fine." I said, "Mom, you're not going to believe what happened last night." She said, "I don't care what happened last night. You're not coming to this meeting." And I finally laid it out there. I told her everything that had happened. And then she finally just, you know, huffed and said, "All right, fine. I'm taking you to a meeting. Let's get a few things straight. This is my home group and you will not join it. These are my friends and you will not love them. And there's a guy there named Jim Lathrop and you will stay the hell away from him. You will not have him for a sponsor. Am I understood?" And you know I was at my bottom, because if I had been in any less pain than I was in at that moment, I would have said, "You know what, forget it. Just forget I even brought it up. Screw this, screw AA. Screw you too, lady." But I was in just enough pain to make that unholy pact with the devil. And by the end of that meeting, I'd done everything my mother told me not to do. Because I got to that meeting and all my mother's friends rushed forward and embraced me. And they said, "You know, you're new, so you really ought to start going to a meeting every day. And this is a good one because we meet every morning at 7:30, so really you ought to join the home group." And when they started that meeting, they said, "If you're new and you're looking for a temporary sponsor, the women should go see Carolyn P. and the men should go see Jim L." What do you do? I did what any good alcoholic son did. I looked at my mother, I shrugged, I flipped her the bird, and then I did everything she told me not to do. And I know today that we're both grateful I did that. See, I didn't know that my mom had a resentment against Jim Lathrop and that was poisoning her relationship with these friends she was telling me to stay away from. And that she, and in fact, woken up that morning with the resolve to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to think two lives got saved that day. And we joke about that a lot. You know, AA has really healed the relationship between my mom and I. It was very toxic and very poisonous and very violent when I was growing up, you know. Classic alcoholic home growing up. Every kind of violence except for sexual, thank God. But a lot of fighting, a lot of screaming, a lot of broken promises, a lot of silent dinners, and a lot of ill-maintained secrecy. And there, you know, I don't have to tell anybody, you know, if you've grown up in an alcoholic home, you know that there's not a whole lot of funny going on in there. But what's beautiful about Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's really healed that relationship. And she and I are actually able to laugh today about stuff that was life and death at the time, including that first meeting. And we both laugh about it all the time. Even, you know, my mom lives in Oklahoma City, and I go see her at Christmas. And we go to meetings together, and I remember she was asked to speak and tell that story. And they turned to me and they said, "Adam, do you want to rebut? Do you have a rebuttal or anything like that?" And I said, "No, it's exactly how it happened, you know." And I think if it had happened any other way, somebody else would be standing here tonight, or you'd be in a lot of trouble, Steph. Somebody wouldn't be here tonight. I don't know. But, you know, I don't remember anything that was said to me at that first meeting. I just remember saying that horrible sentence, "My name is Adam, I'm an alcoholic," and the little old man sitting next to me put his hand on mine and welcomed me home. And I didn't know I was home. He knew it. I was given a 24-hour chip at my first meet, my only 24-hour chip, by a woman whose face was just covered in wine sores. I didn't know that she had only 30 days and was giving it away at the time. I just knew that she looked scary and she had this Southern comfort burn in her voice. You know, she sounded kind of like this. And she was giving everybody who took a chip a hug, and I was scared to go get one. And it's the truth, you know what I mean? And I just remember she put her arms around me, and I exhaled. And I didn't know I'd been holding my breath, you know? And I don't remember anything that anybody said. I remember what people didn't say to me. I remember people did not say to me, "Sorry, kid, one member of your family is more than AA can take, so you got to go." I remember nobody said to me, "You're only 21 years old. You couldn't possibly be done dying yet." And because they might have been right. You know, I mean, I probably was physically capable of drinking more. But, you know, I describe what I'm like when I don't drink, you know, and my skin turns inside out real quickly. And I couldn't take living like that anymore. You know, a lot of the stuff that appeared on my eighth and ninth step, you know, a lot of the amends I had to make were things that I did when I was between drinks. Because it was between drinks that I broke into your apartment and I stole your refrigerator, the booze out of your refrigerator. It was between drinks that I opened up my roommate's wallet, took $20 out, and tried to convince him that it was my $20. It was between drinks that I lied. It was between drinks that I... that I really did the stuff that I'm the most ashamed of, or was at that time. You know, the nice thing about the steps is that I don't have the kind of shame that I had about the kind of person that I was. I mean, it took everything that I had to go through to get to where I am today. You know, and I, you know, if I could have done differently, I probably would have done differently. And I'm not sitting here proud of a lot of the stuff that I did, but I do know that. Just like everything else in sobriety that's caused me pain, you know, even that stuff has turned into experience, strength, and hope. I don't drink and I don't die. I work the steps, and everything that caused me pain turns into experience, strength, and hope, including the stuff that I did between drinks and a lot of the stuff that I did while I was drunk, too. You know, and nobody said to me, you know, "I spilled more than you drank." I mean, God, I was so scared that one of those crusty, mean old-timers was going to get in my face and say, "I spilled more than you drank," you know, because I was primed. I was primed. They just wanted some mean old-timer to say that to me so I could say, "Well, you know what? Maybe if you'd been drinking what you spilled, you would have gotten here at 21, too." You know, and not because... That's funny. It's not funny. But I wanted to say that, not because I was a tough guy or a bad guy, but because I would much rather you kick my ass than make me feel vulnerable. I'd much rather you punch me in the face and hash brown my nose than hurt my feelings. I had always been that way. You know, long before I ever picked up a drink, I had problems. I was your classic high school geek, small in body, big on brains, and even bigger on mouth. And, you know, I had that temper going on because I'd grown up in this alcoholic home and I'd learned to fight from early on, you know, and I didn't know the rest of the world operated like that. I was a very smart child, quite literate and articulate before my first birthday, you know, and my parents had a lot of high hopes and a lot of high expectations. You know, so smart kid that only knew how to fight. My two tools for living were make good grades and when in doubt attack. And they turned me loose on kindergarten. And by the time I was 17 years old, I was just this angry little mess. I was the kid that lived in in-house suspension because some football team jock called me a fag, and I took him by the back of the head, and I smashed it into a locker until he bled. I'm astounded when I think about that, just how insane that was. You know, I've never won a fight in my life, but I've never taken on somebody my own size. You know, and I learned in my fourth step why that was, because if I take somebody on who's my own size and I don't win, people might not think I'm a very good fighter. But if I take on somebody bigger than me, or if I take on more people than one, you know, they might think, well, God, you know, must be a tough little punk if that many people have to jump him, or if somebody that big has to jump him. So, you know, I didn't know that until I did an inventory. There's a lot of things I didn't know until I did an inventory. You know, I'm a college drunk. Any college drunks out there? Okay, a few of you. Any old mill drinkers out there? No old mill drinkers out there? Oh, my God, that's a shame. Oh, cheapest beer. You could buy a case of that for $5. Pure pasteurized horse piss. Never seen a shaft of wheat in its life. You know, and I got to college. I was recruited by the swim team. I was a very good swimmer, and I got recruited by the swim team. And quickly, I became the only swim team member who was shoveling money out of my own pocket to be at a swim team party. Because, you know, I would get drunk and I would just tell these fantastic stories about all these wonderful friends that I had and all these cool adventures that we went on. You know, neither the friends nor the adventures existed, of course. You know, to think I got so upset when I walked in here and I saw something about being restored to sanity. I had imaginary friends and I went on trips in fantasy land when I got drunk, you know. And I liked alcohol because it helped me not mind the fact that I was a poser and a liar. You know, but I had a grandiose ego back then and I didn't even know it. You know, people put two and two together real quickly and figured out I was a liar. And they stopped wanting to hang out with a liar. I would show up at the party and the music would go off. And I'd be like, what? You know, I didn't get it. I didn't get it, you know. And then somebody would come up to me and they'd say, oh, hey, Adam, great, you're here. You know, we all pitched in for another case, so can you give us $5? And I would hand the money over knowing that I was the only one doing it. I handed over my own money. I handed over other people's money. Never want to forget the day I handed over all this. I had a mountain of dirty laundry that was like this high. I was the kind of alcoholic who had no compunction whatsoever about wearing his boxer shorts inside out. Keep coming back. You know, and I was raised better, but you know, I had taken the cup of quarters that I had saved to do my laundry and I had traded it in for that right to drink with people that didn't even like me, you know. See, I didn't know until I did an inventory that what I was essentially saying was that it was more important for me to drink with people that didn't like me than to have the tiny little dignity that comes with wearing clean clothes, you know. And that may not be a big deal and that may not sound like a really big sacrifice, and it's not. But, you know, the story of my alcoholism basically is that I just kind of ripped off or allowed to have ripped off these little tiny bits of my self-esteem until there was nothing left, you know. And then I'm down in the basement drinking beer that I've stolen out of somebody's apartment. Never want to forget the day, you know, the swim team got tired of my company real quickly. They wouldn't even take my money. They wouldn't even take my quarters. They wouldn't take anybody else's money either. You know, so I show up at the frat parties and, you know, I would drop somebody's name and go down there and act like an idiot. One day I dropped somebody's name. They said, you stay right there. They went back down to that mess of cheap beer and meaningless sex, got the person whose name I dropped, brought him upstairs and said, did you bring this guy here? Or did you say he could come over? No. They took me by the back of the shirt and by the back of my jeans and threw me off the steps of the Delta Cap Epsilon house. And another piece of my self-esteem came off. You know, And I kept saying, you know, God, what's so terrible? What is it that I want that's so bad that you got to treat me like this? You know, that I just want to have fun. I just want to be with you guys doing what you're doing. Because it makes me feel comfortable. It makes me not hate myself. It makes me not mind the fact that I'm a liar and a poser. It makes me a good dancer. It makes me conversational. It makes me not mind the fact that there's such a big difference between me and you. You know, but it's really hard to explain all that when you're in midair and they're kind of throwing you off the steps, you know. Anyway, I went to Japan on a geographic cure because I didn't run away in moderation. And that's where I ended up drinking every day, basically. And I promised myself I wasn't going to let that happen either. But, you know, I got there and I had a ball for a while. I'd like to tell you something. I'm making my drinking probably sound like a real terrible experiment in better living through chemistry. And it wasn't. I want to guarantee you all, I had a ball for a while. I loved it. I mean, all night long, playing Tecmo Bowl on Nintendo, drinking Old Milwaukee or Molson's if it was a really good night, and listening to Kurt Cobain howl out with the lights out, it's less dangerous, here we are, now entertain us. I mean, God, when he died, we had an Irish wake for a week, man. You know, I had a ball. I had a lot of fun, and I can't exactly explain what it was that changed all of that, but I do think it was right about the point that I started handing over the quarters for the drink. You know, I didn't realize I was selling out for alcohol, and I didn't realize I was miserable, and I didn't realize that it wasn't getting better and that not drinking wasn't the answer. I knew not drinking wasn't the answer because I would go home for the holidays to my mother and my father, my mother being the sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, therefore no more booze in the house. And within minutes of arriving home, I'm driving everybody up the same wall I'm climbing because I'm used to living by my rules. And it was horrible. Anyway, I got to Japan on a geographic cure, drank myself to my bottom, and ended up at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think it's not a long trip, but it was a hard and fast one. And it may sound really strange to hear somebody say at 21 years old he was tired. But I was tired. I really didn't want to go on living anymore because I knew that alcohol was causing a problem and I knew that not drinking wasn't working either. I learned really soon that not drinking wasn't working either because I was going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is what happened. I'm supposed to tell you what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like today. This is what happened. I've been going to meetings for about 3 weeks. I hadn't had a drink. One more time, I'm in a fight with my mom. I don't know what it is that set me off, but she said, take your things, put them in your backpack, and get the hell out of my house. I don't care if you're sober in AA or not. You will not talk to me like this. I'm going to the store, and when I come back, if you're still here, I'm having the cops take you out. And she left. And I looked around, and I just couldn't believe it. I didn't know what I'd said or done. You know, anybody ever have these, like, weird sober blackouts, you know? You know, and my program at that time had consisted of just don't drink and go to meetings. And that's what just don't drink and go to meetings got me. And that was when I finally realized that there was going to be a whole lot more than this just not drinking thing, that I was going to have to make some changes. My mother did come home. She did find me there. I said, listen, I'll pack up and leave soon, but would you please just take me to a noon meeting? Just drop me off at a noon meeting. Let me do that. I'll come back and I'll pack up. And she did. I don't know why, but she did. But I went to that meeting, and they read the chapter called There's a Solution. And in that chapter, it says something about, if you are as alcoholic as we were, then there is no middle-of-the-road solution. You can either go on drinking to the bitter end, trying to blot out the consciousness of this intolerable situation, or you can accept spiritual help. But if you accept spiritual help, it's because you're doing it because you want to and you're willing to make the effort. And it goes on in there to talk about how none of us like the leveling of pride and, you know, the evaluation of shortcomings that comes with it. I'm kind of paraphrasing. But he said, we saw that it worked in others and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we've been living it. And I read that line and I knew this was the best I could do with just don't drink and go to meetings. This was the best I could do, and it sucked. And that was the day I became willing. That was the day I ended up with a real sponsor, one of those men that you hear about in AA that has gone to school for hard-hearted sponsorship. He didn't care about how I felt. He cared about what I did. He used to say to me all the time, Adam, I don't want to... We would try to read the big book together, and I'm an educated person, and I would try to tell him what I got out of the reading. He'd say, no, shut up. If I wanted to hear anything you had to say about this book, I would have asked you to sponsor me, but I didn't. So shut up. And I'd say, yeah, but he said, see, you're doing it again. I told you to shut up. And up I would shut. He wanted me to say the third step prayer on my knees. I said to him, well, I'm Jewish. I don't pray on my knees. And he gave me that look. You know that sponsored death ray look? You know, one eyebrow goes down, the other eyebrow goes up, and you just know that your mouth has betrayed your mind. Yeah, he gave me that look, and I knew that he knew that I had never done a Jewish thing in my life. Not one thing. I had never been to synagogue. I had never been bar mitzvahed. I ate pork and loved it. And I learned a very interesting lesson that day. The key word in the third step is care. You know, we turn our will and our lives over to the care of a power greater than ourselves. And, you know, the best I could do for God, G-O-D, group of drunks. Because all those group of drunks had seen my mother come in. They helped her get her life together. And if they could work on her, then they had to be able to work on me. All of those people plus me was clearly more powerful than me alone trying to get sober. And I had chosen a member of that group of drunks. You know, and he must have sat there at coffee with some of those other old-timers and said, well, he looks like he's going to stick around, so we're not going to treat him with kid gloves anymore. You know, just lay it on the line for him, Jamie. Don't hold back. You know, whatever you do, don't let him say anything back to you because he's going to think himself right out of this room. You know. He really cared. He cared enough about AA to not let me dick around with it. He cared about AA enough to work with a guy who probably was one of those people you hear about in AA. Nobody's too dumb for Alcoholics Anonymous, but there are a lot of people who are too smart. I was one of those. But he cared enough about me and my desire to stay sober to say that prayer with me and to not let me have my way with it. You know, that was the great effect that was felt at once when I had that third step prayer, you know, was that I realized this person must really care about Alcoholics Anonymous if he's not letting me screw around, and he must really care a lot about me and my desire to not drink. And, you know, that whole group of drunks who didn't tell me I was too young and who didn't throw me out of my first meeting and who welcomed me so warmly, you know, they really must care. You know, and I became willing to turn my thinking and my actions over to that kind of care. And I have to tell you, I haven't had a drink for almost 16 years. And life in your care has been magnificent. Life in your care has been magnificent. It's not always been pretty, but I swear to God, I wouldn't trade it for anything. Not one thing. Some fantastic things have happened in sobriety. You know, I got to go back to Japan several times, sober. And I got to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous there. And, you know, I got to tell you, the last time I lived in Japan, I was there for 2 years. I went to meetings in Japanese. I was the only guy there, the only white guy there one more time. And at 4 or 5 years sober, I was one of the long-timers in that meeting. You know, AA is still pretty much in its infancy over there. And you don't find out about AA until you've been to the psych ward a few times. You know, and it's really tough to go into a meeting like that and say, well, what do you got for me? You know, and that's really where I really learned to be of service, and that's really where I did learn to say yes, and that's really where I did learn to develop the kind of attitude that would allow me to walk into this meeting just to confirm that I was speaking on the 18th and say, oh, you need me tonight? I'm here for you. I got to go back to Japan many times, like I said, and I got to enjoy every minute of it sober, and it's the people in Alcoholics Anonymous that saw me through every step of the way. I graduated from college. I graduated from grad school. I've fallen in love in sobriety. I made some really great amends steps. You know, those people that I was having that bar fight with that night, I made amends to them. They invited me to their wedding. And I couldn't go, unfortunately, because I was going to be living in Japan by the time that they got married, and I couldn't fly back. But I took them out to dinner, and we had this really long talk. And, you know, I'm still in their life today. And it's a very different relationship, but it's a really wonderful, healthy relationship. They trust me with their kids. I'm a guy that used to try to swing a pool cue at them, and they trust me with their kids. You know, that's a big deal. I reconnected with family that I didn't speak to because of my own selfishness. You know, at 3 years sober, I went down to Florida and I reconnected with my father's mother, his sister, and those kids, you know, and my youngest cousin had never met me because I was too resentful and too angry and too wrapped up in myself. And, you know, that little girl wrote me a letter at the end of my stay, and every word was in a different color of magic marker. And she said, I didn't know what to expect when you came here, but I'm so happy you're here, and I really wish you'd stay a couple of days longer. You know, and I hadn't been asked to stay a couple of days longer in a long time. You know, but when you get a letter like that, you don't wonder whether step nine works. That little girl is now 22 years old, and I was at her bar mitzvah. That was the one Jewish thing I finally did. I was at her bat mitzvah. It was wonderful. It was beautiful. I was the only person who came from my family to be there, and I was so proud. And we're good friends. That little cousin of mine and I'm really good friends with most of my family today. You know, I'm really lucky I live in Denver and I'm close to my family, you know, and a lot of them don't get Alcoholics Anonymous. A lot of them don't like AA either, but they love me. And it's okay that they don't like AA. It doesn't take anything away from the person that I am that they don't like AA. It's a shame that they don't appreciate the fact that the person that they love today and are wanting to have in their lives was brought to them by Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's okay. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to be humble and to remember that even for me, you know, the successes that I've had are really evidence of a higher power working in my life more than just me doing anything, really. There's been some tough times, too. I've been unemployed in sobriety. I've been homeless in sobriety. I've had my heart broken in sobriety. I have been sick in sobriety. You know, I have a central nervous system disorder that had to get treated right after I got fired from my job in New York. And it was the end of my health insurance. And I remember saying to people, I was living in New York City at the time, and that's a weird place to be unemployed and sober. And I remember saying to people, God, I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, and they would look at me and they'd say, God didn't bring you this far to drop you now. I just wanted to punch people when they said that to me, you know. I don't know about you, I hate being placated to when I'm in pain. When I'm in pain, it is unique, it is different, it is mine, and you don't know where I'm at, right? AA proves me wrong every time, you know, because, you know, thank God for prayer and meditation, you know, because one day I was meditating and that stupid phrase came to mind, and one of the gears in my brain skipped a cog, and what came to mind was, God didn't bring me this far for me to drop him now. I didn't know what to do with that for a long time, but I'm here to tell you, that came to me 7 years ago, and it's still something I use today to see me through a lot of really hard times, because I do believe that today, you know, that God, whether it's in the form of a group of drunks or whether it's what I finally come to believe is a power greater than myself that I pray to, you know, has really done a good job with me. He's made me fit to be in this world. You know, the kind of person that I was before was on his way right into the penitentiary. I have no doubt about that. You know, I'm able to suit up and show up, regardless of what's being handed to me. I'm capable. I'm honest. You know, what you see is what you get. I'm not projecting what I think I want you to see and then later feeling guilty about it so that I have to drink and I don't feel the feelings of guilt anymore. You know, what you see is what you get. And there's some really nice integrity about that. It's better than the kind of integrity that comes with wearing clean underwear. You know, it's fantastic. And it sees me through. It helps me to remember that, you know, if I don't drink and I don't die, the pain that I'm going through always becomes experience, strength, and hope. I never know when and I never know how. But it's funny how newcomers appear at at times like this. You know, I was going through a terrible breakup. There was a house involved. And all I've got at that time is a desire to stay sober and a sponsee who would say just incredible things. You know, things like, God, you know, he would show up at meetings where I was sitting. He would say, my sponsor tells me that I'm supposed to stop taking other people's inventories, and I have to keep reminding him that I'm gay. And, you know, alcoholics are above average intelligence. And but he also would say things that really were very profound to me. So he would say, I'm looking at what you're doing right now, and I can't believe you're not drinking. I can't believe it. You know, if nothing else, I've learned that AA works. You know, and I'd love to tell you he was sober from that day to this. He had a few relapses, but he's sober now. He's in law school in New York, and he's doing really well. You know, previous times that I've been in pain, you know, a newcomer shows up, you know. A guy living above me is 200 pounds overweight, has a beard out like this, and he's got these deep gouges in his wrist because he can't quit. And he started following me around to my home group, and we started talking about the steps, and I started sponsoring him, and, you know, that guy's now a tenured professor at the University of Kentucky, and he's lost 100 of that 200 pounds that he was overweight. He runs marathons, and he's an excellent member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's married and invites me into his home. And I'm not saying standing up here saying that I have something to do with that. I just know that that guy showed up at just the right time, you know, so that I could remember that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety when nothing else fails. When all else fails, I mean. It's a good life. I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's been a rich, full, amazing existence, you know, and I just, I'm very fortunate that I get to be up here and that I get to tell you all, especially those of you that are new, that AA works. It's worked really well for me. Give it a chance. I'll close with just this. I like to have the big book up in case I have to look up the answers when I'm talking. But this is my favorite line in the book, and this is my message to those of you who are new, and then I'll sit down. Thank you again, by the way, for asking me to share. This is from page 163. We know what you're thinking. You're saying to yourself, I'm jittery and alone. I couldn't do that. But you can. You forget that you have just now tapped a source of power much greater than yourself. To duplicate with such backing what we have accomplished is only a matter of willingness, patience, and labor. So get willing, get patient, and get to work. Thank you very much for letting me share.